it's nothing. Just a blank. Wouldn't it be funny if you found a harmonica inside, or a calendar? But there's nothing there. Nothing at all. It's disgusting. It almost drove me mad. Listen, do you know what I did afterwards? I gave her a quick lay, and then I turned my back on her. Yeah, I picked up a book and I read. You can get something out of a book, even a bad book. But a cunt? It's just sheer loss of time. It just so happened that as he was concluding his speech, a whore gave us the eye. Without the slightest transition, he says to me abruptly, "Would you like to give her a tumble? It won't cost much. She'll take the two of us on." And without waiting for a reply, he staggers to his feet and goes over to her. In a few minutes, he comes back. "It's all fixed," he says. "Finish your beer. She's hungry. There's nothing doing anymore at this hour. She'll take the both of us for 15 francs. We'll go to my room. It'll be cheaper." On the way to the hotel, the girl is shivering so that we have to stop and buy her a coffee. She's a rather gentle sort of creature, and not at all bad to look at. She evidently knows Van Norden, knows there's nothing to expect from him but the 15 francs. "You haven't got any dough," he says, mumbling to me under his breath. As I haven't a centime in my pocket, I don't quite see the point of this until he bursts out, "For Christ's sake, remember that we're broke. Don't get tender-hearted when we get upstairs. She's going to ask you for a little extra. I know this cunt. I could get her for 10 francs if I wanted to. There's no use spoiling them." "Il est méchant, celui-là," she says to me, gathering the drift of his remarks in her dull way. "Non, il n'est pas méchant, il est très gentil." She shakes her head laughingly. "Je le connais bien, ce type." And then she commences a hard luck story about the hospital and the back rent and the baby in the country, but she doesn't overdo it. She knows that our ears are stopped, but the misery is there inside her, like a stone, and there's no room for any other thoughts. She isn't trying to make an appeal to our sympathies. She's just shifting this big weight inside her from one place to another. I rather like her. I hope to Christ she hasn't got a disease. In the room, she goes about her preparations mechanically. "There isn't a crust of bread about, by any chance?" she inquires, as she squats over the bidet. Van Norden laughs at this. "Here, take a drink," he says, shoving a bottle at her. She doesn't want anything to drink. Her stomach's already on the bum, she complains. "That's just a line with her," says Van Norden. "Don't let her work on your sympathies. Just the same, I wish she'd talk about something else. How the hell can you get up any passion when you've got a starving cunt on your hands?" "Precisely. We haven't any passion, either of us. And as for her, one might as well expect her to produce a diamond necklace as to show a spark of passion. But there's the 15 francs, and something has to be done about it. It's like a state of war. The moment the condition is precipitated, nobody thinks about anything but peace, about getting it over with. And yet nobody has the courage to lay down his arms, to say, 'I'm fed up with it, I'm through.' No, there's 15 francs somewhere, which nobody gives a damn about anymore, and which nobody is going to get in the end anyhow, but the 15 francs is like the primal cause of things, and rather than listen to one's own voice, rather than walk out on the primal cause, one surrenders to the situation. One goes on butchering and butchering, and the more cowardly one feels, the more heroically does he behave. Until a day when the bottom drops out, and suddenly all the guns are silenced, and the stretcher-bearers pick up the maimed and bleeding heroes and pin medals on their chest. Then one has the rest of his life to think about the 15 francs. One hasn't any eyes or arms or legs, but he has the consolation of dreaming for the rest of his days about the 15 francs, which everybody has forgotten. It's exactly like a state of war. I can't get it out of my head. The way she works over me, to blow a spark of passion into me, makes me think what a damned poor soldier I'd be if I was ever silly enough to be trapped like this and dragged to the front. I know for my part that I'd surrender everything, honor included, in order to get out of the mess. I haven't any stomach for it, and that's all there is to it. But she's got her mind set on the 15 francs, and if I don't want to fight about it, she's going to make me fight. But you can't put fight into a man's guts if he hasn't any fight in him. There are some of us so cowardly that you can't ever make heroes of us, not even if you frighten us to death. We know too much, maybe. There are some of us who don't live in the moment, who live a little ahead or a little behind. My mind is on the peace treaty all the time. I can't forget that it was the 15 francs which started all the trouble. 15 francs! What does 15 francs mean to me? particularly since it's not my 15 francs. Van Norden seems to have a more normal attitude about it. He doesn't care a rap about the 15 francs either now. It's the situation itself which intrigues him. It seems to call for a show of mettle. His manhood is involved. The 15 francs are lost, whether we succeed or not. There's something more involved. Not just manhood, perhaps, but will. It's like a man in the trenches again. He doesn't know anymore why he should go on living, because if he escapes now, he'll only be caught later. But he goes on just the same. And even though he has the soul of a cockroach and has admitted as much to himself, give him a gun or a knife or even just his bare nails, and he'll go on slaughtering and slaughtering. He'd slaughter a million men rather than stop and ask himself why. As I watch Van Norden tackle her, it seems to me that I'm looking at a machine whose cogs have slipped. Left to themselves, they could go on this way forever, grinding and slipping without ever anything happening, until a hand shuts the motor off. The sight of them coupled like a pair of goats without the least spark of passion, grinding and grinding away for no reason except the 15 francs, washes away every bit of feeling I have, except the inhuman one of satisfying my curiosity. The girl is lying on the edge of the bed, and Van Norden is bent over her like a satyr with his 2 feet solidly planted on the floor. I am sitting on a chair behind him, watching their movements with a cool, scientific detachment. It doesn't matter to me if it should last forever. It's like watching one of those crazy machines which throw the newspaper out, millions and billions and trillions of them, with their meaningless headlines. The machine seems more sensible, crazy as it is, and more fascinating to watch than the human beings and the events which produced it. My interest in Van Norden and the girl is nil. If I could sit like this and watch every single performance going on at this minute all over the world, my interest would be even less than nil. I wouldn't be able to differentiate between this phenomenon and the rain falling or a volcano erupting. As long as that spark of passion is missing, there is no human significance in the performance. The machine is better to watch, and these two are like a machine which has slipped its cogs. It needs the touch of a human hand to set it right. It needs a mechanic. I get down on my knees behind Van Norden, and I examine the machine more attentively. The girl throws her head on one side and gives me a despairing look. "It's no use," she says. "It's impossible." Upon which Van Norden sets to work with renewed energy, just like an old billy goat. He's such an obstinate cuss that he'll break his horns rather than give up, and he's getting sore now because I'm tickling him in the rump. "For God's sake, Joe, give it up. You'll kill the poor girl." "Leave me alone," he grunts. "I almost got it in that time." The posture and the determined way in which he blurts this out suddenly bring to my mind, for the second time, the remembrance of my dream. Only now it seems as though that broomstick, which he had so nonchalantly slung under his arm as he walked away, is lost forever. It is like the sequel to the dream, the same Van Norden, but minus the primal cause. He's like a hero come back from the war, a poor maimed bastard living out the reality of his dreams. Wherever he sits himself, the chair collapses. Whatever door he enters, the room is empty. Whatever he puts in his mouth leaves a bad taste. Everything is just the same as it was before. The elements are unchanged. The dream is no different than the reality. Only between the time he went to sleep and the time he woke up, his body was stolen. He's like a machine throwing out newspapers, millions and billions of them every day, and the front page is loaded with catastrophes, with riots, murders, explosions, collisions, but he doesn't feel anything. If somebody doesn't turn the switch off, he'll never know what it means to die. You can't die if your own proper body has been stolen. You can get over a cunt and work away like a billy goat until eternity. You can go to the trenches and be blown to bits. Nothing will create that spark of passion if there isn't the intervention of a human hand. Somebody has to put his hand into the machine and let it be wrenched off if the cogs are to mesh again. Somebody has to do this without hope of reward, without concern over the 15 francs. Somebody whose chest is so thin that a medal would make him hunchbacked. And somebody has to throw a feed into a starving cunt without fear of pushing it out again. Otherwise, this show will go on forever. There's no way out of the mess. After sucking the boss's ass for a whole week, It's the thing to do here. I managed to land Peckover's job. He died all right, the poor devil, a few hours after he hit the bottom of the shaft. And just as I predicted, they gave him a fine funeral, with solemn mass, huge wreaths, and everything. Tout compris. And after the ceremonies, they regaled themselves, the upstairs guys, at a bistro. It was too bad Peckover couldn't have had just a little snack. He would have appreciated it so much to sit with the men upstairs and hear his own name mentioned so frequently. I must say right at the start that I haven't a thing to complain about. It's like being in a lunatic asylum with permission to masturbate for the rest of your life. The world is brought right under my nose, and all that is requested of me is to punctuate the calamities. There is nothing in which these slick guys upstairs do not put their fingers. No joy, no misery passes unnoticed. They live among the hard facts of life, reality, as it is called. It is the reality of a swamp, and they are the frogs who have nothing better to do than to croak. The more they croak, the more real life becomes. Lawyer, priest, doctor, politician, newspaperman. These are the quacks who have their fingers on the pulse of the world. A constant atmosphere of calamity. It's marvelous. It's as if the barometer never changed, as if the flag were always at half-mast. One can see now how the idea of heaven takes hold of men's consciousness, how it gains ground even when all the props have been knocked from under it. There must be another world beside this swamp in which everything is dumped pell-mell. It's hard to imagine what it can be like, this heaven that men dream about. A frog's heaven, no doubt. Miasma, scum, pond lilies, stagnant water. Sit on a lily pad unmolested and croak all day. Something like that, I imagine. They have a wonderful therapeutic effect upon me, these catastrophes which I proofread. Imagine a state of perfect immunity, a charmed existence, a life of absolute security in the midst of poison bacilli. Nothing touches me. Neither earthquakes, nor explosions, nor riots, nor famine, nor collisions, nor wars, nor revolutions. I am inoculated against every disease, every calamity, every sorrow and misery. It's the culmination of a life of fortitude. Seated at my little niche, all the poisons which the world gives off each day pass through my hands. Not even a fingernail gets stained. I am absolutely immune. I am even better off than a laboratory attendant, because there are no bad odors here, just the smell of lead burning. The world can blow up. I'll be here just the same, to put in a comma or a semicolon. I may even touch a little overtime, for with an event like that, there's bound to be a final extra. When the world blows up and the final edition has gone to press, the proofreaders will quietly gather up all commas, semicolons, hyphens, asterisks, brackets, parentheses, periods, exclamation marks, etc., and put them in a little box over the editorial chair. Comme ça, tout est réglé. None of my companions seem to understand why I appear so contented. They grumble all the time. They have ambitions. They want to show their pride and spleen. A good proofreader has no ambitions, no pride, no spleen. A good proofreader is a little like God Almighty. He's in the world, but not of it. He's for Sundays only. Sunday is his night off. On Sundays, he steps down from his pedestal and shows his ass to the faithful. Once a week, he listens in on all the private grief and misery of the world. It's enough to last him for the rest of the week. The rest of the week he remains in the frozen winter marshes, an absolute, an impeccable absolute, with only a vaccination mark to distinguish him from the immense void. The greatest calamity for a proofreader is the threat of losing his job. When we get together in the break, the question that sends a shiver down our spines is, what'll you do if you lose your job? For the man in the paddock, whose duty it is to sweep up manure, the supreme terror is the possibility of a world without horses. To tell him that it is disgusting to spend one's life shoveling up hot turds is a piece of imbecility. A man can get to love shit if his livelihood depends on it, if his happiness is involved. This life, which, if I were still a man with pride, honor, ambition, and so forth, would seem like the bottom rung of degradation, I welcome now, as an invalid welcomes death. It's a negative reality, just like death, a sort of heaven without the pain and terror of dying. In this Thonian world, the only thing of importance is orthography and punctuation. It doesn't matter what the nature of the calamity is, only whether it is spelled right. Everything is on one level, whether it be the latest fashion for evening gowns, a new battleship, a plague, a high explosive, an astronomic discovery, a bank run, a railroad wreck, a bull market, a 100-to-1 shot, an execution, a stick-up, an assassination, or what. Nothing escapes the proofreader's eye, but nothing penetrates his bulletproof vest. To the Hindu Aga Mir, Madame Shear, formerly Mrs. Stev, writes saying she is quite satisfied with his work. I was married June 6th, and I thank you. We are very happy, and I hope that thanks to your power it will be so forever. I am sending you by telegraph money order the sum of, to reward you. The Hindu Aga Mir foretells your future and reads all your thoughts in a precise and inexplicable way. He will advise you, will help you rid yourself of all your worries and troubles of all kinds, etc. Call or write 20 Avenue McMahon, Paris. He reads all your thoughts in a marvelous way. I take it that means without exception, from the most trivial thoughts to the most shameless. He must have a lot of time on his hands, this Aga Mir. Or does he only concentrate on the thoughts of those who send money by telegraph money order? In the same edition, I notice a headline announcing that the universe is expanding so fast it may burst, and underneath it is the photograph of a splitting headache. And then there is a spiel about the pearl, signed Tekla. The oyster produces both, he informs all and sundry, both the wild or oriental pearl and the cultured pearl. On the same day, at the Cathedral of Trier, the Germans are exhibiting the coat of Christ. It's the first time it's been taken out of the mothballs in 42 years. Nothing said about the pants and vest. In Salzburg, also the same day, two mice were born in a man's stomach, believe it or not. A famous movie actress is shown with her legs crossed. She is taking a rest in Hyde Park, and underneath, a well-known painter remarks, "I'll admit that Mrs. Coolidge has such charm and personality that she would have been one of the 12 famous Americans, even had her husband not been president." From an interview with Mr. Humal of Vienna, I glean the following. "Before I stop," said Mr. Humal, "I'd like to say that faultless cut and fit does not suffice. The proof of good tailoring is seen in the wearing. A suit must bend to the body, yet keep its line when the wearer is walking or sitting." And whenever there is an explosion in a coal mine, a British coal mine, notice please that the King and Queen always send their condolences promptly by telegraph. And they always attend the important races, though the other day, according to the copy, it was at the Derby, I believe, heavy rains began to fall, much to the surprise of the King and Queen. More heartrending, however, is an item like this. It is claimed in Italy that the persecutions are not against the Church, but nevertheless they are conducted against the most exquisite parts of the Church. It is claimed that they are not against the Pope, but they are against the very heart and eyes of the Pope. I had to travel precisely all around the world to find just such a comfortable, agreeable niche as this. It seems incredible almost. How could I have foreseen in America, with all those firecrackers they put up your ass to give you pep and courage, that the ideal position for a man of my temperament was to look for orthographic mistakes? Over there you think of nothing but becoming President of the United States someday. Potentially every man is presidential timber. Here it's different. Here every man is potentially a zero. If you become something or somebody, it is an accident, a miracle. The chances are 1,000 to 1 that you will never leave your native village. The chances are 1,000 to 1 that you'll have your legs shot off or your eyes blown out, unless the miracle happens and you find yourself a general or a rear admiral. But it's just because the chances are all against you, just because there is so little hope, that life is sweet over here. Day by day, no yesterdays and no tomorrows. The barometer never changes. The flag is always at half-mast. You wear a piece of black crepe on your arm. You have a little ribbon in your buttonhole. And if you are lucky enough to afford it, you buy yourself a pair of artificial lightweight limbs, aluminum preferably. which does not prevent you from enjoying an aperitif or looking at the animals in the zoo or flirting with the vultures who sail up and down the boulevards, always on the alert for fresh carrion. Time passes. If you're a stranger and your papers are in order, you can expose yourself to an